From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast to Coast AM. Later on, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories, followed by conversations with Linda. But here's what's happening. Some states are making a last-ditch effort to block the Obama administration from ceding the U.S. oversight of the Internet's domain name system. They have filed suit in federal court ahead of an imminent deadline for the handoff. The attorney generals from Texas, Arizona, Oklahoma, Nevada have asked a judge to step in and stop the transition to an international oversight body. Now, the U.S. government has been in charge of all the domain names for more than 30 years, thanks to a Commerce Department agency's oversight of a very powerful but obscure Los Angeles-based not-for-profit called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. If the transfer takes place, as it's set to do on October 1st, the suit argues people will lose the predictability, the certainty, the protections that continue to flow from the federal stewardship of the Internet. And also, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is cautioning the public about so-called stalking apps. An attorney for the FTC is saying that these apps are spyware, and they enable a third party to use your phone, to track you or monitor details of your smartphone, such as your phone conversations, the text messages, emails, photos, passwords. Lauren Weinstein, expert on the Internet. First of all, Lauren, want to get your reaction to giving up the Internet handoff. What does this all mean?
It's really just political gamesmanship on the part of some politicians now, unfortunately. I've been working in this area now, as you know, since the early days of the ARPANET. We're talking many, many years ago. I've watched this entire system be built up. I know the details of this transition plan. There's nothing there to be afraid of. It's not a perfect plan, but it was crafted in a way so that Americans have nothing to worry about. Foreign countries won't be able to censor us. They won't be able to take away our domain names. We've got politicians now who see an opportunity to take a very technical topic that most people don't understand and try to bend it in an alarmist way, and I just think it's shameful that they're trying to do that. The transition should take place. Nothing will change as far as we're concerned. In fact, something to keep in mind, they keep talking about censorship. These other countries are able to censor without any transition. They go to their ISPs in country and they just order them to cut certain things off. People find ways around it in many cases. But there's nothing that would change. This would not give Russia or China or North Korea or anyone else the ability to impose censorship on other countries. In particular, they couldn't do it on the USA.
But what is scary, this stalking app, what's this all about?
Yeah, no, this has been around for a while, and it was kind of funny when I was thinking about this earlier. The very first YouTube video I ever did back in 2007, and you can still find it if you go to Google and you do a search for "is your cell phone bugged," those exact words, "is your cell phone bugged." Back at the time I did that video, there were stalking apps and bugging apps, but they were very obscure, and the odds of anyone actually getting them on their phone were very, very low. Now, things have changed. Back then, I was using you see my hand holding a first-generation smartphone. Now we've got much more advanced phones and much more advanced exploits. The real problem is that these apps do exist. They can monitor your location. They can bug your conversations. They can send them off to stalkers. It's very hard for a non-technical person to determine whether or not something like that is on their phones. The only good part, and I put good in quotation marks, is that it's pretty difficult to do that to a phone remotely. It usually requires that somebody get physical access to your phone for some 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is, to root the phone, jailbreak the phone, and then put the app on there. But once they've done that, it can be very hard to make that determination. Now, what can you do about it? Since most people aren't going to be able to determine whether or not it's there, the recourses are pretty drastic. One of them is to factory reset the phone, using the manufacturer's instructions to do that. That'll blow away all your data. It'll blow away the malware. It also will, of course, send a signal ultimately to whoever was stalking you when all of a sudden their app stops working and they realize what you've done. So that's something to keep in mind. But short of that, there isn't very much you can do other than be very careful about who gets hold of your phone in the first place. And of course, if you're living in an abusive relationship or something, that might be very difficult to do.
Good point. Lauren, okay, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure talking to you about all these technological issues. Sad story out of New Jersey. A woman was killed and 108 others injured when a crowded commuter train crashed through a barrier at the busy Hoboken, New Jersey station, lurched across the waiting area during the height of the Thursday morning rush hour. Authorities are talking to the engineer of that train. The U.S. economic growth was less sluggish than previously thought in the second quarter as the exports grew more than the imports and businesses raised their investments. They say, is it a hopeful sign for economic outlook? Well, let's check in with Mish Shedlock, the investment advisor. What do you think, Mish?
Hey, well, I saw those reports today, and actually there was another report today. They revised second quarter GDP up 0.3%, 0.3 percentage points from 1.1 to 1.4. If you actually dig into the details, you see that gross domestic investment actually declined despite of this. Now, these are just two different measures of the same thing, George. You know, one of them, they track two different things. One of them tracks products. One of them tracks income and investment. Over time, they matched. But gross domestic investment actually declined. And I put some charts up there on my blog. Actually, I've not written it yet, but it's going to go out there tonight, mishtalk.com, where I'm going to show you gross domestic investment is rolling over. I expect GDP to follow. It always does. 11, I've tracked 14 instances of these. The last 11 of them, we followed by a recession. Three of them were false signals. So is this a false signal, George? I don't know. But look, we discussed this going back a year now, right? Neither you nor I thought the Fed would hike this year. Guess what? They haven't hiked yet.
We've been right.
I don't think they're going to hike in December. This economy is a lot weaker than people think.
Every advisor that I have on the show, Mish, says that there's going to be a bubble burst. Do you feel that way too?
Absolutely. That's another thing we've discussed. It might not happen the same way as we saw in 2000 or in 2007, where everything collapsed all at once. What the Fed did manage to do, you can give them credit for this. You have to look at things both ways. They did manage to revive the bond market, but they kept this tactic of QE going on too long, too much, too far, too many years. They actually had a chance to hike. The economy was genuinely strengthening 2 years ago. They had a chance to hike then. They didn't do it. Now they're desperate. They want to hike. And the reason why they want to hike, George, is they want to be prepared. This is the way they think. They have some ammunition so they can fight the next recession. We're not going to get there, George. If they hike one more time, I think that'll be it. And I don't think they get that hike in.
All right, Mish. One more thing. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. This is my birthday. I'm here playing cards with friends, celebrating. We're playing Euchre and Widow Whist, if anyone knows those games.
Enjoy the day.
Thanks, George.
You've been a great guest for us. In a moment, we're going to talk to the author of a book called A Black Knight for the Bluegrass Bell. Wait till you hear who the author is next on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our next guest spent the majority of his life on the radio, in school, in church. Now, he worked for radio stations all around the country, and he's been one of the hosts of this very program. He received his Master's of Divinity degree from the Columbia Theological Seminary in Atlanta, a deacon in the Episcopal Church, working on his Ph.D. from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. He is none other than our dear friend, Ian Punnett. Ian, welcome.
I absolutely love to hear you read my bio. It actually sounds like I've done something.
How are you?
I'm doing so well. In fact, I thank you for having me back on, and I have a little announcement about this book coming up and a little mix of good news and bad news. But as you were mentioning birthday, so You know that Art Volo, radio's best friend,
yes,
just turned 71.
He is amazing. He has recorded just about everything in radio.
Yeah, and he loves
it. He's a walking dictionary.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking to somebody. Did you used to work at a radio station that was haunted?
Yes.
Is it WCAR?
It used to be the original WCAR, which has been sold, and now the call letters may be back, but the station, Ian, was based in a funeral home.
Now, I worked for a while for a station that was based in a funeral home, and it was haunted as hell. So it was, I mean, people would hear the body elevator going off all the time, the elevator that used to go down to the basement to bring up the caskets when it was a funeral home, and they would see things all the time. Did you ever, so WCAR was what kind of station when you worked?
It was a music news talk. We didn't have the kind of talk radio that we have today.
Right.
So it was a music station, but it was on AM, and AM, you know, FM wasn't really strong in those days. And I'm going back to, 1971. It was right before I was with Marconi.
Right, exactly.
But this was in an old funeral home in Detroit, and we could hear the elevators, the body elevators, going up and down when we were there late at night, and, you know, hardly anybody was at the station. It really was a weird, scary place.
I think it's too strange a coincidence that we should both work at radio stations in different parts of the country that were built into former funeral homes. We both had the same experience. So this was the one near Fifth Mile or something like that in
Detroit.
Detroit. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so a guy named Fred Vobey was telling me this story, and he said that it was renowned. Every broadcaster who worked there would walk away with at least one ghost story.
I think that's why I got hired. People felt sorry for me. They wanted to get me out of that thing.
And was it from there that you went into TV?
Uh-huh. That's right. TV, 1974, I went to the NBC station at the time and then bounced along, did my thing.
So a ghost scared you into TV.
That's right, literally. Get me out of there. So you've got a book that's kind of scary, too, and strange. I wrote a little snippet for it. It's called A Black Night for the Bluegrass Bell. But this strikes home for you, doesn't it?
It does. In fact, thank you for the blurb. If you want to see George's blurb, it's on the Coast to Coast AM website. We put up the new dust jacket, and there's three quotes on the back. From people that are all connected in one way or another to Coast. And it was so good to hear Lauren on earlier, too. That just cracked me up, how many times he and I shared the air together. So this is a story that involves a murder in 1936. We're coming up rapidly, just days away from the 80th anniversary of the death of a woman named Verna Gar Taylor, who just happened to be my grandmother's first cousin, and they were close, and it became such a big story that at the time when the first verdict was handed down, I don't know that I mentioned this last time, the trial of the former lieutenant governor of Kentucky, who was accused of her murder, a guy named General Denhart, when the verdict came down, he was top of the fold on newspapers all over the country on the same day that the Hindenburg exploded.
Right.
And so, you know, that was like, that just an indication of just how big that story was. And everybody, it was one of those stories like the O.J. Simpson trial, where people all over the country were taking opinions about whether or not he could have done it. And a lot of it was based on the idea of how could a politician ever do such a dastardly thing as kill somebody. He was getting the benefit of the doubt.
And he was very arrogant, wasn't he?
He was known for that. Arrogant and belligerent, and he was known for being a very mean drunk. And so, you know, there were many people that worked under him that came out immediately and said, wait, no, you know, this guy did, this is so in keeping with his character, and many people that served under him. His nickname was the Iron General, but it wasn't for a nice reason that they called him that, or because he was so brave. They called him the Iron General because he came down too hard on everything. And so he was very harsh and was harsh punishments and And he was a strike breaker too for a while when they would send in the Kentucky Guard, and long after, you know, people, however you feel about strikes, he was known for taking a few, you know, headshots with a baton that was probably not necessary, but something that he enjoyed doing. So he had this record, and he had this biography of his own that people found completely consistent with him being a killer, and other people just couldn't accept that. They just thought, no, somebody who's achieved that level, you know, lieutenant governor, he would never do such a thing. And he was able to get a hung jury for the first trial, and that begins a lot of the story that happens afterward too.
Did your family talk a lot about this story? How did it come to your forefront?
All the time. I grew up with the story. In fact, we were raised with, I used, you know, and my mother told the story all the time, and she was also researching it herself. And when she was a school teacher, she had started her own book on it and worked on it for many years. And a lot of the research I was able to use came down to things that she had collected. In fact, at the last minute, you know how this is, I was almost done with the book, and she mentioned something offhand to me that she had never told me before, and that was that the family had come to my grandfather, who had been a police detective, and they'd come to my grandfather and asked him to investigate this guy. And they said, we don't feel good about him going out with Verna. It just doesn't, you know, for all of his reputation, she's telling us some pretty terrible things he does when he's been drinking. And so my grandfather personally investigated him, came back, and came to the family and gave his report, and he referred to him as a foul ball.
Wow.
Said, I just love that because it sounds so 1930s, doesn't it?
It sure does.
You know, tell her to get away from him as quick as possible. He's a foul ball.
Obviously, she couldn't get away.
Well, that night they went out to, he took her out and she was going to break up with him. And that was the whole point of he had proposed to her. She said she would consider it, but it just wasn't going to work for her, and so she was not going to accept his proposal. Back in the days when people used to do that, right, when they would take a look, mm-hmm. they'd take the ring, and they would think about it for a while, and then one way or another, they would say yes or no.
And most said yes in those days.
Yeah, and she was going to say no. She told the whole family. Everybody was relieved. It's finally going to be over. You know, and they were waiting for her to come back, and unfortunately, she came back dead.
How was she murdered, Ian?
Well, this is the part that, like, I can't even for a minute understand how some people can still say that we'll never know who did this. The autopsy report showed two things. She had been sexually assaulted that night. There were deep bruises on the insides of her thighs from either a palm or a knee that had been trying to force her legs apart. There was no other sign of sexual assault other than that, but it was way up on the inside of her thighs. And that the other thing that the autopsy proved is that the bullet entered underneath her left breast in an upward trajectory that split through her heart.
Oh, jeez.
It was a .45, right? So big caliber.
Instantly.
Yeah, big caliber bullet.
Yes.
And then exited out just below her shoulder. So it was going up and through from the left to the right. But when they found her body, she was holding a glove in her left hand. And the gun was on the right side of her body when they found it. And so Denhart and his lawyers claimed that she committed suicide by shooting herself with her right hand through her left side in an upward trajectory with a gun that was about 11 inches long, and that she was able to do that, although we'll never understand why a woman would want to commit suicide that way.
And she probably couldn't even squeeze the trigger on that kind of a gun.
Well, it was that big a gun that even in the trial, when his attorneys were trying to demonstrate to the jury, here's how he would have done it, he almost dropped it. And the gun weighed like, you know, it's a big...
Oh, it's like a little handheld cannon.
Exactly, the total hand cannon. And so the attorney almost dropped it, but he was able to get a hung jury And again, the story continues as he walks away, at least temporarily, as a free man. But as you'll see in A Black Knight for the Bluegrass Bell, there's more to that story. And it eventually involves the family deciding that they have to get involved as well.
Okay, and we're going to come back after this short break. We're going to talk a little bit more about you and what you've been doing. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines. Here's your chance to talk to an old friend and host, Ian Punnett, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. This hour, we have Ian Punnett. Next hour, Linda Moulton Howe with some incredible stories that she has investigated. I understand, my friend, that you were robbed or something strange happened to you.
Just remind me, though. The last time I saw Linda Moulton Howe, we were all together.
That's right.
Ian, we were all in Twin Cities. Yeah, it was so weird, George. This is, you know, this will end up being a plug for an old Coast to Coast sponsor in a way. But I was driving to, so now I'm in Ada, Ohio, home of Ohio Northern University, George Gulbis, and the Wilson Football Factory.
What are you? You're teaching there now.
I am.
Okay.
Teaching public speaking and photojournalism, and I'll be teaching video storytelling in the fall.
While you're working on your PhD.
Yeah, finishing my dissertation on crime stories and murder stories.
Ooh.
And how we use murder stories. Yeah, this has really turned into something. I went back and I studied all of In Cold Blood, and I studied Helter Skelter again, and I studied Ann Rule and a bunch of other things. I think it's a fun dissertation to do. I hope it passes.
Great story, D.B. Cooper. That's not a murder story, but that's another good one.
Yeah, and I love those crime narratives. It almost doesn't matter what they are. So anyway, I was driving across from Phoenix to Ohio Northern, and on the very first night I stopped, which was in Albuquerque, I got up the next morning, was pumping gas, getting ready to go, and I lost all of my ID, all of my credit cards, and my cell phone, which I have a cell phone wallet. And I think, I don't want to think the worst of people, but I think somebody had intentionally distracted me and was just talking to me while I was pumping the gas, and I think somebody else took it, and I didn't notice it because I'd already run my credit card through the pump. So it was one of those things where I got about 5 miles, and I looked around, and I'm like, wait, where's my wallet? Turned around, they were gone, and they had already charged 4 or 5 things in the first 20 minutes in the time it took me to turn.
Oh, what a pain. Now, how did they get it physically?
I don't know.
Was it on you?
It was either on the back fender of my car while I was pumping and they took it when I wasn't noticing it, or they reached in and I don't remember where I put it after I ran.
I mean, the cell phone probably was in your car.
Well, the cell phone was together. So it was a cell phone wallet. So they got it together. So everything was together.
All right.
My wallet. But they were smart enough to not turn on the cell phone, right? Because then I had ID.
You
and I
pinged them.
You could have right away, but it was because of LifeLock, the old Coast to Coast sponsor.
And their current sponsor.
Are they still good?
Oh, yeah, still with us.
Completely worked. And I've had them ever since I was hosting Coast to Coast, and I used to listen to the commercial. I thought I should get that. So I have it for that. I have it for me, and I had it for everybody in my family. So it was just literally like one phone call to LifeLock, and they were on it. They had the system all set up, and not a bad thing ever happened. And I never had to pay for those charges that they were able to get. And
that's
they
a horrible
tried to get
feeling.
In cash, but they didn't get that.
I mean, so there you are going across country, literally, and you have no credit cards, you have no license, you don't have a phone.
No.
What did you do? Did you continue onward or go back?
I had to get to orientation for the first day of teaching, so I had to be there in 3 days. So and I had the dog in the car with me, so I couldn't. I mean, it was just so I had to just run the gauntlet.
What a mess!
I had like $400 cash with me. I had it in my front pocket, so that was the only good thing. And I just had to make a run for it and hope that I didn't get pulled over because I had no proof of it. I had nothing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was a little crazy.
Let's take some calls for you too while we continue chatting. Ian Punnett with us. Let's go to Laura in Colorado, first time caller. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Well, good evening, George, and good evening, Ian. How are you all doing?
Great.
Hi, Laura.
Well, Ian, I wanted to, I can't wait to read your book. I'm also writing a book about my great-grandfather being murdered.
Oh, cool.
And I wanted to ask you,
sure.
How do you fill in the blanks? Because, you know, when it's a 100-year-old murder or so,
right.
The only people that we have to rely on are people that, you know, for example, like my aunt that's in her late 70s. All the other folks that I could have asked a long time ago, they've already passed on, including my grandmother. And so I'm just kind of wondering, you know, how do you fill in the blanks and some of the missing
sure.
gaps?
Well, let me just say, when I said, oh, cool, I think it's cool that you're keeping his story alive by telling that story. And I think I'm a big believer in family histories, and I don't think anybody ever truly dies until they're completely forgotten. So I think it's great that you're writing it. In Black Knight for Bluegrass Bell, a lot of the research I got, thank you to a cousin of mine who notified me that they had just found the transcript from these trials. And they were at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville. So I got on a plane literally like 6 hours and flew there to read the transcript. You might be surprised what exists. You literally, I mean, I hit every single county record, every newspaper archive. Especially back then, murders perhaps weren't as common, and they might have been written about more. In my case of my kin, she became the subject of a series of articles in true crime magazines. So I had that to work with too, is that story just kind of kept going even long after she had been killed. So that was part of it. Then the other part of it is the family histories, and to sit down, if all you have left is an aunt, that's a good start. But if you look, I mean, I found photos and little comments under photos, and my mother was very helpful. And it just, you might be surprised how much you can find. It takes a lot of legwork, but some more is out there than you can imagine sometimes. And go to libraries, and then if you're writing it like true crime, which is what I did, instead of trying to write it like a historical book, I think there's a lot more license in true crime in capturing a narrative as opposed to trying to put a footnote on everything you find. So think about writing it in that, you know, in that style, in that genre, and that gives you a little bit more latitude to fill in those blanks.
Ian, tell me about the fascination with these murders.
Well,
were you always into that?
Yeah, I always have been, and I was raised with it. My mother always told the stories of Jack the Ripper, and we're just... what we learn from murder stories, to me, is we learn a lot about who we are as people and what we value. And it's how, in a lot of ways, it's not the murder. I'm not all that interested in, I hate death and pain and that kind of evil. But what I find so interesting is how people rally afterward. And what do families do after a murder? What do communities do? How did the justice system work or not work? You know, that's what's interesting to me about true crime, is true crime in a way is always subversive. True crime is either challenging the police for not doing the investigation right, or is challenging the judge for not getting the sentence right, whether he was found guilty or not guilty. I mean, there's just so many different ways to go with that. And I think that's what's so interesting about the murders that we choose to write about. I mean, think about how many stories... how many movies keep getting made about the same murder stories? And I think we learn from them with every new generation, because I think there's almost a character about them that's like folklore.
Indeed, like indeed. Stories. Next up, Steve's in South Dakota. You're on with Ian Punnett. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, Ian. I just really enjoyed you so much when you were on the coast.
Thank you.
And I wanted to know if you remember a show that you did. I know that I got an education from it. It was a show on a book called The Last Train from Hiroshima.
Oh, well, Charles Pellegrino.
Yes.
And Charlie wrote one of the blurbs on for my book.
Oh, he's just such an amazing author. I got the MP3 audio CD of the book, and I was horrified.
Oh, it's
just horrified at what the survivors went through from the A-bombs over Japan.
Well, I went to Japan earlier this year I remain very friendly with Charles Pellegrino, and I was very interested in what happened to him after the book came out. And he'd been accused of being a fraud for a while, and all this, and then he was cleared of that, and the book was then republished and is currently available again. Yeah. And but I went and I interviewed a lot of the people that he had interviewed when he was in doing the research for the. And I went to Nagasaki to the bomb memorial and the one in Hiroshima. And if you haven't been yet, and if you enjoyed that book, The Last Train to Hiroshima, you would really you owe it to yourself to get to Japan. Make it on.
Well, I've been into the Oriental martial arts like judo, karate. And I've been wanting to go to Japan and visit the Kodokan.
Yeah.
And a lot of other places in Japan.
Yeah.
But it was a brutal book. It was just brutal. Now, how are your ears?
Oh, thank you. The tinnitus is always going to be what it is, but it helps not to be on the radio. It helps not to have headphones on every day. And so I count my little blessings there. And it's fun to be a teacher. So, you know, it's not, I start every day with a smile on my face, and I love working with young people here at Ohio Northern. It's good.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. I was going to ask you that, too, the tinnitus.
Yeah. It is what it is. But then, so you like the cover of the book?
Which you changed. So tell me about that.
Well, see, this is the good news and the bad news. The cover was holding us up, and so we went back, and the publisher did this entirely on his own. He did a great job with it, and he kind of captured that true crime style on the cover, and it's got that slightly sort of 1930s magazine vibe to it too. And so there on the cover, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you can see it. If you click onto that link too, you can go to you can get a copy of it. It's not going to be out now on Saturday. That's the bad news. Was originally it was going to ship on Saturday, but because of the new dust jacket, which I think is worth the trade-off because it looks so good, but because of that, it'll be delayed until November 1st. And I know there's a lot of people that were really counting on it. I'm so grateful for all the excitement about it, but it couldn't be helped. And I think the new cover is just too good, and it's worth it to me, but I'm so sorry. So that's the bad news, is it'll be a little bit late coming out in November instead of this weekend.
I remember back April 28th, 2001, you took a Sunday off. Alan Corbett had me fill in for you, and that was my very first show.
You did great.
15 plus years ago, Ian. Unbelievable.
Well, I love that part about your career, that I could be touched in some way to it.
You are.
To me. So I love that. And you're always kind to mention that. And I think it was in good hands that night, and it has been ever since. You've got the hand on the tiller. And I listen all the time, just if nothing else, if it's late for me, because it's, I'm on East Coast time now. So I will listen sometimes just before I go to bed, just so I can hear the news segment and always hear what you're up to. So
you are doing some podcasting. Tell us about that.
Well, I did one. So I did a kind of an exclusive for Coast to Coast on the first couple chapters of the book. And I will, some people ask me for another one, but frankly, teaching, getting up and getting here and getting robbed and all that stuff, it really threw me off. So I will belatedly get out another podcast between now and when the book drops, and I'll send it on over to Lex. And if you all put it up on the website, then at least people can hear another installment from the book story.
Let's go to Jerry in Ohio, east of the Rockies. Hey, Jerry, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey, Ian. I miss you. You always had some cool guests on.
I was blessed to have great producers like Lisa and Gina, and yes, I think I had an embarrassment of riches of good guests.
Yeah. You're just down the road from Lima. Have you done anything about the John Dillinger killings?
You know, that is so interesting, because I'm just beginning to figure out how cool Ohio is. I was just in Lima today. I was over at WLIO-TV. Tell me more about what you know about that.
Well, he got caught. They had robbed my brain is not as good.
Oh,
as
that's cool.
Me, trust me.
Go ahead, tell me.
National Guard thing in Indiana, over, I think, in Warsaw. and stole like some BARs or whatever. Anyway, he's got caught. He's in the Allen County Jail. Three of his guys come into the jail. They kill the sheriff. They bust him out. And two of them gets caught and go on trial, and they both get electrocuted. But
that was in Allen County in Northwest Ohio.
Oh, yeah, Lima. Oh,
okay.
Yeah,
I've got to look that up. So I saw a plaque about something when I was driving, and I meant to go back and read it. So I love historical markers, and I'm just beginning to understand. Around here, the Underground Railroad, of course, was huge, and the number of slaves that were able to escape up to Canada, coming up through Kentucky and then Ohio, pretty prolific. They still don't know all of the people that were involved in all the places, but every so once in a while they excavate and they find another sign, another place where obviously people have been hiding. Off and on. So it's a cool part of the country. I feel blessed to be.
Well, you might want to check out some guy that was in the Lima Police Department for like 30 years, put a book out like 20 years ago that's supposed to be the definitive book on the John.
Oh, cool. I will do that. I thank you for that. I love those kind of stories. So
yeah.
That's definitely what I'm studying. So thank you.
Okay. Ian, with the moments that we have left, you have been working on so many things over the past few years. I can't really keep track of you, the PhD, the books,
right,
and everything else. What's next for you?
Well, you know, this, can I throw one more weird thing at you?
You sure can.
So I can say this. I haven't actually made a public announcement about this, but I had a chance to be on the production team as the assistant director and the associate producer for some arts projects in the Twin Cities before I left to go to Phoenix to start the PhD. And we were making HD productions, like these big 10 and 11 camera shoots of operas that were being put on by the Minnesota Opera Company. And the last one that I was involved with will be shown this winter, I believe just before Christmas, nationally on PBS. And so it will have a chance to air nationally. The opera is of the movie Doubt. That's one of the last things I had a chance to do before I went back and started the PhD. So it's kind of cool that it gets to run on national television.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's weird.
That is truly exciting. How's
the
wife doing?
I'll literally be sitting there at TV with a popcorn, like waiting for my name to come up like an idiot.
How's the family doing with you going all over the place?
Yeah, that's the only downside. Of course, my wife is so successful in Phoenix that I'm here. It's just me and my snoring dog, Jack. And so we're making it together on our own. My wife was just here a couple weekends ago, and I'll see her again in Kentucky when the book comes out, and we're going to make a couple appearances. Like, I put up a link for the Harlan Haunted Fest, the Harlan Haunt Fest in Kentucky. There's a link there for that. I'll be there to talk about the book. They're huge Coast to Coast fans, obviously, there. And then also I'll be at the Kentucky Book Fair presenting my material. And that's later on. I think
super.
It's up there too.
Ian, my friend, you take care. If there's ever anything we can do for you, you know where to find us.
You just did it. And thank you for supporting the book. And I wish I had better news. I wish I could say it was coming out this weekend, but November 1st, I promise.
It'll happen.
We'll get a copy to you soon.
It'll happen. Ian Punnett, great guy. Up next, Linda Moulton Howe with stories of incredible high strangeness.